So today's guest is Bradley Nichols. He is an assistant professor of history at the University of Missouri. His research is on modern Germany, modern Europe, Holocaust and genocide studies, war in society, and race and ethnicity. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Your dissertation, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is becoming a book, is The Hunt for Lost Blood, Nazi Germanization Policy in Occupied Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
I've invited Bradley to give us a brief history lesson on the Nazi movement and to help us discern what key things we should learn to avoid such a terrible movement from taking hold of our country. So I won't go deep into details of your book. People can read it if they want to know more. I did have a question, though. One takeaway from your book that I hadn't considered before was how the Nazi Party's search for good blood would make it really difficult for them, since they'd be kicking people out of their country that had been part of a functioning society. This would seem like a huge setback to production, to community, and therefore morale, and a huge time commitment. How were they so successful in spite of this? And was this push for good blood late into the war?
So it actually starts pretty much right away, as soon as the Germans conquer Poland, and it expands gradually as they take over the rest of Europe to other territories as well. And there's sort of a push and a pull factor going on throughout this period and running across all of these various policies and all of these various countries. The push factor is the Nazis wanted to get rid of or cleanse anyone they considered to be racially undesirable, quote unquote, while at the same time preserving or incorporating people in foreign lands, non-German speakers, whom they considered to be, quote unquote, racially valuable. So the question of whether it's an advantage or a disadvantage to sort of purge people, to push people out, to deport people somewhere, or just kill them, the Nazis always viewed this in terms of race, and that a functioning society, a functioning economy, that this would flourish if the citizenry were, quote unquote, racially pure, or at least as close to that as you could get. All of this is, of course, imagined and fantasy. It's all in their heads. There is no racial distinction, obviously, between Germans and Poles, or Germans and French, or Germans and... This is all in their heads, but it very much is a core element of their ideology. But contrary to what their ideology said, because of the needs of a wartime economy, particularly a labor shortage on the home front, the Nazis actually have to bring foreigners into Germany in huge numbers, by the millions, as forced laborers. Labor shortage created, or at the very least exacerbated, by the fact that pretty much all young men are in the army. Mm-hmm. They don't want to, they're very ambivalent about bringing women into the workforce, as was done during World War II in America or Britain, for instance. The Nazis do that eventually, but they were very wary of that. And so their solution was essentially to enslave other Europeans, conquered peoples. So that's kind of how they make up the difference here in the shortfall in labor, is by forcing conquered peoples to work for them in Germany. Getting rid of people, on the other hand, from Germany, that's mainly reserved for Jews, for Roma, Sinti. It's mainly Jews that they get rid of, and they do this, and it's justified and accepted by Germans, even if they happen to be, you know, somebody's neighbors, because Jews are perceived to be an internal threat. The perception driving a lot of Nazi anti-Jewish policy was that German defeat in World War I had been instigated and caused by the Jews, that the shadowy conspiracy of Jews had brought down German morale on the home front during World War I. And the idea was that in World War II, they were not going to let this happen again. As for what the population thought about this, some people bought into this delusion. But for others, kind of whatever moral qualms they had about it, Jews represented only a tiny fraction of the German population. And for most people, the conclusion or the rationalization was, well, we're not going to speak out against our government in a time of war on behalf of this minority whom we've always felt is overrepresented, has too much power, too much money, too much influence. That's sort of a broad outline of how the German people responded to the deportation of their Jewish neighbors. Some of them bought into the ideology, most of them were just apathetic. They really just didn't care. They didn't see it as something worth making a fuss over. And in that sense, it doesn't really have an impact on morale on the German home front.
Okay. Yeah, and I think we'll get into the motivations here shortly. I want to kind of switch away from your book now, just to talk about kind of what's going on right now and in our politics. So Nazi Germany and Hitler get brought up a lot in moral debates and in politics. This is especially prescient these days when Vladimir Putin is claiming the Ukrainians are Nazis, all the while Putin is committing genocide against Ukraine. But even during times of relative peace, we see it. For example, every president is eventually compared to Hitler. Obama was claimed to be tyrannical, and the Democrats were called socialists, and scary messages of the Democrats trying to take your guns away. Trump is also being compared to Hitler. He, again, is tyrannical, fear-mongering, hyper-nationalist, xenophobic. Some see such an equivocation or analogy to be an automatic loss of any argument. It does seem to me that by not allowing ourselves to see the similarities in our politics and ideologies of today, that we risk repeating these events. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, to start with, I would say that historians always have to be very careful in drawing comparisons or analogies between different time periods, just because the contexts are always different. Every historical era is unique in its own way and has elements that can certainly be compared to elements in other time periods, but others that don't match up. So the trick here is always to weigh, kind of, you know, do the similarities outweigh the contrasts here? And what do the similarities mean? In the case of, let's say with Ukraine, with the war in Ukraine, we'll start with that. I would push back against the idea that the Russians are committing genocide per se in Ukraine. Clearly, they're committing atrocities on a horrendous scale and obviously deserve recrimination for that. But it's not the same thing. It's certainly not the same thing as the Holocaust. It's not genocide, although the UN definition is sort of a little...
Right, I might have been using it inaccurately, yeah.
No, it's a term, it's a very, I mean, this gets right to the heart of what you asked. It's a very politicized term. It's a very ambiguous term. The UN definition is very difficult to quantify because it has this clause about the destruction of a group in whole or in part. Well, what does the in part mean? What's the threshold? Right? How many people have to be killed? Are we just engaging in a process of body counts, which seems pretty tasteless than is? But genocide, you know, most scholars of the topic, of the subject, would consider genocide to be the deliberate attempt to systematically wipe a people out entirely. And that's pretty rare in history, right? For all of the... you know, the catastrophes and the blood-soaked record of human existence, there's atrocities to go around committed by pretty much everyone. But something like the Holocaust, where you're trying to wipe out all of the men, women, and children completely, that's relatively rare. So I wouldn't say that what's going on in Ukraine is genocide, even though obviously it's awful and we shouldn't have a moral hierarchy where, like, genocide is the worst thing and these other war crimes and atrocities are somehow... lesser. These are all terrible things. Mm-hmm. Full stop. What I see is kind of the more intriguing or relevant parallel is the logic and justification that Putin has used for invading Ukraine. Namely that people in Eastern Ukraine, Russian speakers, that they're Russian and therefore should belong to the Russian Federation, that they should not be living under foreign Ukrainian rule. That's very, very similar, almost identical to what the pretext for German expansion in the late 1930s was. Hitler and the Nazis, in each move they made to expand their territory short of war in Central Europe, in Austria, and then Czechoslovakia, and then eventually Poland, they always claimed they were doing this to quote unquote liberate German speakers who lived in those areas. And there were a lot of ethnic Germans who lived in these kind of border areas. That's one of the reasons you get a lot of confusion about who's who. Who's a German, who's a Pole, who's a German, who's a Czech. That kind of justification for military expansion, for territorial aggression, that is a very, very striking parallel between what Putin has done in Ukraine and what Hitler did in the late 1930s in Central Europe. This kind of this this logic of our ethnic brethren are being persecuted by this foreign country, so we need to go in and seize control of the territory. It's our right to control this territory because our people live there. Mm-hmm. That is very similar. Now, Putin is not Hitler. Again, we have to be careful about making these analogies. They're not the same thing. Putin obviously is a terrible human being. He's not Hitler. Nevertheless, there are similarities certainly there in the logic of expansion, of atrocities, which are justified in the name of this act of quote-unquote liberating Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine. The interesting thing is the twist here that you mentioned where they, you know, they accuse the Ukrainians of being Nazis.
Right.
And this is a good segue into sort of why we see this kind of rhetoric in our own national politics, because the Nazis, certainly in Western culture and Western historical consciousness, they're the ultimate embodiment of evil. Mm-hmm. Whenever you want to demonize someone or attack them to the utmost, it's the go-to weapon to just say, oh, you're a Nazi, or to equate people with Nazis. And we see this in various forms in our own country on both sides of the political spectrum, to be sure, in ways that are not really helpful. You know, it's a technique of demonization more than an accurate reflection of real historical parallels that can be identified in most cases. In some cases, I think it's valid. I'm actually moderating a forum for a journal, Central European History, right now, we publish later this year, where we discuss precisely this question of why is Nazi Germany, why is the Third Reich so prominent in American cultural and political discourse? Like, why is that the go-to boogeyman bad guy we use to vilify people we don't like or don't agree with? And the short answer is exactly that, that because of the legacy of World War II, because of the legacy of the Holocaust, and rightly so, the Nazis are viewed as sort of this ultimate epitome of human evil, certainly of 20th century evil, that can then be applied to whatever you want. Again, usually in ways that are extremely inaccurate. I think about, I had a student, this is earlier this year, repeated the rhetoric that vaccine mandates were somehow tantamount to the persecution of German Jews in the 1930s. And it's like, no, right. Sorry. Like there is no equivalence here whatsoever. German Jews in the 1930s, you know, before the genocidal phase of the Holocaust begins, they're pariahs. They are excluded from German society and persecuted in pretty much every conceivable way. That is a far cry from being forced to get a vaccine. So that kind of stuff is just dumb, in my opinion. That being said, we can certainly see parallels in how particularly the far right has been mobilized by the same kind of xenophobic rhetoric that was essential to the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1930s. Again, I don't want to create an equivalence here between the one and the other, but there are parallels, particularly with anti-Semitism and how anti-Semitism is used to explain immigration. Obviously, we just had this horrible shooting in Buffalo recently where the perpetrator had bought into this idea of the Great Replacement, that whites were being quote-unquote replaced by a conspiracy of Jews bringing immigrants into America to change its demographic complexion. Like, that kind of stuff is very similar to what the Nazis argued about Jews. Mm-hmm. That Jews were responsible for racial mixing. The term is miscegenation that often gets used. There was a lot of talk about this in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s because the French had used colonial African troops in Europe during World War I. Had used African colonial troops to occupy parts of Western Germany after World War I. And so you start to get this rhetoric claiming that Jews are responsible for bringing Black Africans into interbreed with Germans and destroy German civilization and so forth and so on. Those kinds of ideological parallels are there between fascism in the 1930s in Europe and the far right in America today. Beyond sort of just the like the kind of broader xenophobia, there are specific ideological parallels. Now, that's not to say, obviously, that Republicans are all anti-Semites somehow, or, you know, it's a fraction of them. It's a fraction of the far right that buys into this sort of thing. But I think the important point to keep in mind here is that it didn't take a majority of Germans believing in Nazi ideology for the Nazis to come to power. Mm-hmm. The Nazis never get more than 33% of the vote in a free and fair election. And even after that, once they're sort of secure in power, you would never see a majority of Germans agreeing with the kind of anti-Semitism or any other ideological component of Nazism that precipitated violence, genocidal violence. You would never, like, if you had, like, hypothetically polled Germans in 1940 or 1941 and said, do you think all Jews deserve to die? The vast majority would have said no. But that didn't matter. It was enough that a small, active component of the population believed in this sort of thing.
Right. I think that you bringing up this replacement theory makes me think, you know, maybe a small fraction are, you know, racist, xenophobic on the right. But this replacement theory is kind of a watered down version of that, that, you know, is more acceptable and is actually not some small fraction.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. And I think that's the most insidious thing about it, is that it can, the essence, the vile essence of it and the implications of that claim that people don't think through, the general logic of the argument can be made applicable and respectable to a large number of people who otherwise would not follow through on the violent implications of those who really tout the ideology. I think you're absolutely right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's enough for a large number of people to, like, sort of buy into this.
Right. Be complacent and let it happen.
Complacent to the point where they're complacent and tacitly accept it. That's enough. It doesn't take a nation of, you know, bloodthirsty anti-Semites. That's not what the Germans were.
Right.
There are a lot of anti-Semitism in Germany. But to say that, you know, all or most Germans were virulent anti-Semites just isn't true. It didn't take that. It just took the kind of vague suspicion toward Jews
mm-hmm.
that was considered to be respectable. For instance, there was a widespread perception in Germany that Jews weren't necessarily racially other or engaged in some conspiracy against Germany, or as an international conspiracy to dominate the world or anything like that, but that they were overrepresented. That they had too much authority. I touched on this earlier, that they were overrepresented in business, in the arts, in politics, and that was a problem, because who's to say that they're not more loyal to Jews, their co-religionists, in other countries, that they don't have German interest at heart?
Mm.
That sounds like a much more plausible and reasonable, quote unquote, argument that a lot of people who are not bloodthirsty anti-Semites can buy into. And the Nazis essentially use those kinds of broader perceptions. They're still prejudices. There are levels here, right? There's a difference between someone who feels that Jews are overrepresented in politics or business, SS officer responsible for a concentration camp. There are differences in the intensity of prejudice that we have to recognize and grapple with. But I think you're absolutely right that, you know, it's how you portray these vile arguments in a more mainstream way that doesn't seem as extreme. That was crucial to the chain of events, the momentum that made something like the Holocaust possible, because Germans just didn't feel compelled to do anything to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
In part because of those reasons, in part because of the war, as I mentioned earlier. But I think the perception of Jews is somehow a threat, even if it's not viewed in these sort of explicitly racist or conspiratorial terms. It was enough. So I think the parallel there is right on.
Okay. So I've got a list of points that I want to hit. We might have talked about them already, but I think lest someone thinks that we're just getting opinion and not really based off of facts, I have some facts here that I want to go through.
Sure.
So I think a good place to start would be going through the Nazi platform, or the National Socialist German Workers' Party platform that was published February 24th, 1920.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a good rundown of what was motivating the people.
Mm-hmm.
If not their true motivations, at least what was being sold to the people and must have resonated with the people of Germany for the movement to be allowed.
Sure.
So in the first two points, it starts out with the right of self-determination, mm-hmm. equal rights, and the annulment of the peace treaty of Versailles. It seems the German people were feeling powerless, like they did not have political power, rights, and freedoms. For example, point 9, in quote, all German citizens must have equal rights and duties. Can you provide some context why they are feeling powerless? What was the state of Germany that led them to be in that state?
The short answer here is the aftermath of World War I. There's just no getting around this. Because of the way in which the peace terms of the Versailles Treaty that ended World War I were created and essentially imposed on Germany without any German involvement at the negotiating table. The Germans often referred to it not as the Versailles Treaty, but as the Versailles Diktat, that it had been dictated to them that they would lose territory in Europe, which they did, that they would lose their overseas colonial empire, which they did, that they would have to pay reparations and an indemnity for the war. And above all, probably the most notorious feature of the Versailles Treaty was that it forced the Germans to accept sole moral responsibility for World War I. So in all these ways, Germans are humiliated. What was a great power nation felt very much slighted and aggrieved because of all these things. As for this language of equality among German rights for German citizens, we have to always bear in mind that what the Nazis mean by that is equality among people whom they consider to be racially valuable or racially superior Germans. They don't consider Jews to be Germans, so they don't even qualify for any of this. They don't consider people who are physically or mentally disabled to be actual Germans. So when they say equality of rights among German citizens, there's a huge catch there in that they reserve the right to define who a German is and who therefore is entitled to rights, who therefore is entitled to citizenship. That's really for them to decide. And the rights they're talking about are essentially more on kind of an economic level than a political one. Obviously, the Nazi regime is a dictatorship. They don't have basic civil liberties. So there's a lot of kind of hogwash to this argument about equality of German citizens and rights. This is what a lot of people will point to the socialism part of National Socialism. And I always tell my students in class, like, this is basically a ruse. You know, the Nazis believe in a national community where everyone's sort of on the same level in theory, but not in practice. You know, they don't implement any socialist policies kind of in the Marxist vein. Like, they don't redistribute wealth. They don't establish collective national ownership of industry or the economy. They're virulently anti-socialist. They're virulently anti-communist. So that is sort of it's very misleading.
Heavily militarized.
Oh, yeah.
So they've got that hierarchy going too.
I mean, Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf a lot about hierarchy, about a hierarchically organized society. And the Nazis definitely believed in that. They believed that life was governed by a racial hierarchy, both sort of domestically in a society and in terms of international relations as well. Again, this sort of biological language and perception of history. Part of that is some people are born better than others. There's always a tension between that and this idea of we are all one folk, we are all one people. So I don't want to say that this unifying message is pure rhetoric and pure propaganda. It's not mutually exclusive to say that the Nazis believed in that sort of thing, believed that they were creating equality among all Germans, again, Germans as defined by them. It wasn't contradictory to them, at least, to say that, yet at the same time, run a nationwide system of concentration camps where Germans who speak out have no rights at all.
The end goal that the utopia would eventually have gotten that, but you know, the transient was not that equal society.
Yeah, absolutely. And the utopian element is crucial here. I mean, that's the idea, is that we're creating this perfect, we're going to create this perfect society where everyone will live in harmony just once all of these quote unquote undesirables are gone,
right,
or put in their place. And again, it's the Nazis who define who is desirable and undesirable, who deserves rights, who deserves equality.
Okay, so much of the platform is about economic prosperity. Point three, we demand land and soil, colonies to feed our people. Point seven, we demand that the state make its duties to provide opportunities of employment. Point 11, they demanded the abolition of all income obtained without labor or effort. And point 12, personal gain from the war must be termed a crime against the nation. Further, points 13 through 15, nationalization of all enterprises, profit sharing, and pensions. Point 16, communalization of the large department stores. Point 17, abolition of ground rent. So what is the state of the economy and the standard of living leading up to the creation of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, and what was the cause?
So it's pretty dire. In the post-war years, the German economy is in ruins because of the war. The situation is made worse by this financial indemnity imposed on the post-war German government, the Weimar Republic, as it's known. And essentially what the government does, there's already economic dislocation from the strains of the war, of trying to fund and prosecute a total war effort that essentially wrecks the economy. I mean, this is true pretty much everywhere in Europe, not just in Germany. What makes it worse in Germany is to make these reparations payments, the government essentially just starts printing money, more and more money, which leads to one of the worst bouts of hyperinflation in history, where currency is essentially worthless. So we have all these pictures from post-World War I years in Germany of people like with wheelbarrows full of cash going to buy like a loaf of bread, or like using German paper currency as wallpaper because it's worthless. So the economic situation is very, very dire. It would stabilize a bit. Things would get better in the mid to late 1920s in Germany until the Great Depression hits, when everything just goes right back down the tubes. But I should point out that this is really, it's a good follow-up question, because it allows us to elaborate on some of the points about what Nazi social and economic policy actually was, and how they're able to use this rhetoric of equality and fairness and justice to mobilize people. A couple of different points here in the different items that you ran through. There's a lot of anti-Semitism baked into what these seemingly reasonable economic policy proposals are. The one about department stores in particular, this was department stores, you know, this is sort of like the equivalent of Walmart today destroying local retail. Department stores were considered to be Jewish enterprises that ruined the average German small craftsman, tradesman, shop owner, whatever. And this is just one example of how the Nazis use anti-Semitism and this kind of rhetoric of socialism to gain popular support by framing capitalism itself as a Jewish phenomenon. So the Nazis are always kind of straddling the fence between, you know, we're not communists, we're not socialists, we hate them. We consider their ideas of equality to be antithetical to nature. But we're not Western liberal bourgeois capitalists either. And we see capitalism as being corrupting, as being sort of inimical to the security of the German people. There's a lot of, I mean, you mentioned the word collectivism here, where there's too much individualism. This is why one reason why the Nazis were anti-democratic. They didn't like that idea of individualism. And this ideology, this rhetoric, it is really useful for taking advantage of people's economic resentment. The Nazis would often use the term materialism as a stand-in for capitalism, because they didn't want to sort of like attack capitalism head on for fear that they'd be labeled communist or socialist, which they definitely did not want again. So what they do is they use this term materialism as a kind of symbol or signifier for everything bad about capitalism. You know, war profiteering is mentioned there. There's a sort of exorbitant, the exploitation of renters is another good example of this. And they take all of the associated unhappiness with those conditions of a modern capitalist society, and they say the Jews are responsible for that. That's Jewish. This is something foisted on you by Jews. If we have a Judenfrei, a Jew-free economy, a political economy, then everyone will be equal and we'll live together in harmony and we'll all have our utopia. Now, again, that's the ideal here. But the Nazis never do anything to downward, there's no downward redistribution of wealth. There's no kind of, there's not a lot of economic leveling once the Nazis take power. So again, it's not as if this is just like a ruse or a pretext. They really believe this stuff, but they're not actually doing anything. They're not doing much to reduce income inequality, for instance. When the Nazis take power, they do end the Great Depression, or for the most part, end it earlier in Germany than anywhere else in Europe and in the West in general. They restore levels of prosperity to an extent for most Germans, which is why most Germans came to support the Nazi regime in large part. But it's nowhere near equivalent to the kind of like violent, radical egalitarianism of, say, the Soviet Union. it uses that language of social justice and social equality for a message and a program and an agenda that is much darker and not really concerned with that in the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it sounds like even though there was a small population of Jewish people, that they probably helped each other as a lot of minorities do, and that they were fairly successful at it. And the other Germans who were poor resented them for their success, regardless of it, and thought that they were the cause of them being poor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think that kind of gets to my third question, but I'll go ahead and just state it anyway, because I want to make sure we're backed by the party platform, what it says, is in agreement with what we're saying. So the citizens were either xenophobic or at least willing to allow xenophobia to prosper. Again, back to the platform, point five, any person who is not a citizen will be able to live in Germany only as a guest and must be subject to legislation for aliens. Point seven and eight, foreign nationals, non-citizens, are to be expelled from the Reich, and any further immigration of non-Germans is to be prevented. Further, point 23, all editors and editorial employees of newspapers appearing in the German language must be German by race. They were especially xenophobic in regard to Jewish people. Point four, only nationals, Volksgenossen, can be citizens of the state. Only persons of German blood can be nationals regardless of religious affiliation. No Jew can therefore be a German national.
Mm-hmm.
Point 24, the party fights against the Jewish materialistic spirit within and around us. So I think that explains, or I think what we had been talking about explains the animus towards the non-German people and especially Jewish people. It seems a leap to go and commit genocide against a people.
Yeah, it's important to bear in mind here that despite what some scholars have claimed, and you can sort of point to some of Hitler's early political statements and certainly see violent intentions, violent ideation towards Jews. But it's not as if there's like a plan for what becomes the quote unquote final solution to the Jewish question, the Holocaust, in the 1920s. You can see the kind of core elements of the logic that can lead to that later in the NSDAP platform, particularly this idea that Jews are not German, they're foreign. They need to be expelled or removed from Germany. Certainly the implication of that will remove where? Where are you going to send them? Are you just going to deport them somewhere? Well, what happens when you take over the rest of Europe? Where are you going to send them then? Throughout the war, as the war sort of escalates, the Nazis had these various schemes and proposals and plans of, you know, we're going to ship them all somewhere in Eastern Poland in a reservation and leave them there. And, you know, they'll be separate from us. Then at one point it says after the Germans conquer France and presumably will take over France's overseas colonial empire, say we're going to ship them all to Madagascar, all European Jews, or at least those within our control, and they'll be gone. We'll be rid of them. And presumably they'll die out there. In the run-up to the invasion of the Soviet Union, 1941, then the plan shifts to, you know, again, these are ridiculous, totally impractical schemes. Then the plan becomes we're going to deport them all to Siberia in the Arctic once we take over Russia, Soviet Russia. Well, when that's not possible, it's never really feasible to begin with, but when they don't defeat the Soviets, they have to remove them because that's their ideology says they have to do. The only other thing left to do is to kill them because you can't physically remove them. You can't just ship them somewhere. So the logic that leads to extermination, yes, it's baked into these sort of core elements of Nazi ideology that are outlined very early on in the history of the Nazi movement and its party platform. But there's a long road and a lot of stuff that has to happen in the meantime between then and 1941, when the Holocaust as we know it begins in earnest. I mean, the Germans had to conquer all of Europe first, and that was by no means a foregone conclusion. So yes, absolutely, it's a leap to sort of say that we have this document from the early 1920s, and it shows they're planning to do this from the beginning. As to why they're increasingly led down that road, again, a lot of this goes back to what I said about the Nazis' perception of World War I and how it ended. That Jews were a corrosive force in any circumstance, that they were corrupting German society. That's why they had to be removed, expelled, whatever. The atmosphere of war here is essential because of this notion that Jews were somehow agitators and saboteurs who were going to undermine morale on the home front from within. We have to get rid of them because of that, so that nothing like the end of World War I, when there was unrest on the German home front, there's a collapse of morale. We want to make sure nothing like that happens again. So again, that's based on circumstances, right? That's based on how the war, how World War II unfolds and develops. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking sort of for the kind of a point by point chain of events that leads to just, we're killing Jews, but we're going to sort of just put them in ghettos and deport them somewhere. You want to look at how you get from that to Auschwitz. You really got to look at how the Nazis are responding to military developments in the first couple of years of World War II. So it is definitely a leap. You're right.
Okay. In some moral debates, people like Jordan Peterson, kind of a famous person these days, he'll give Hitler or the Nazis in general as an example of how atheism is the doctrine that either led to or enabled Hitler and the Nazis to commit actions of hate. Some counter that argument, pointing out that Hitler was raised Catholic, and point out the role of the Catholic Church among other Christian denominations like Lutheranism in creating an atmosphere of hostility toward Judaism and Jews. Further, a 1939 census of Nazis found less than 2% were atheist, and some have pointed out the belt buckles worn by the Nazis stated "Gott mit uns," or "God with us." In regard to the party platform, point 24 says, "The party as such stands for positive Christianity without associating itself with any particular denomination." Mm-hmm. So what role did religion or atheism play in Hitler's and the Nazis' thought process, actions, and justifications? Was atheism the cause of their motivations, or did it somehow leave them morally defenseless to performing such terrible acts?
Yeah, so the role of religion in the Third Reich and in the Nazi movement is a very, very complex one. I'll start it out by saying I don't think they did the things they did because of atheism, but it's you can certainly make the argument that the leadership of the Nazi party was very anti-Christian. I mean, they a lot of them believed in this sort of going back to this ancient Germanic paganism, you know, before Christianity. A lot of them saw Christianity too as a Jewish phenomenon. You have a movement known as the German Christians and the Protestant within the Protestant church that sort of their agenda is to purge Christianity of its quote unquote Jewish elements. So like the whole Old Testament. So there's an antipathy toward Christianity, sort of the top echelon of the Nazi elite in terms of their ideology. On the other hand, they know they can't take this too far for political reasons, because the vast majority of Germans are still Christian, whether they're Catholic or Protestant. I think it was about two to one in terms of the numbers, about a third, a little over a third of Germans were Catholic, about two thirds Protestant. The vast majority of the German population are devout or at least believing Christians.
And the Nazis themselves.
And many of the Nazis themselves, many of them. Not in the top, you know, Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, you know, those kinds of guys, Hitler's cronies, most of them were fervently anti-Christian. But they know they can't take this too far and translate it into any kind of real anti-church policy, because German people wouldn't have. And this gets you into sort of the dynamics of a dictatorship where, yes, the state is in control and there's no formal political rights, but they're still always responsive to popular opinion, right? Like, they can't just do whatever they want. Something to keep in mind with, you know, how Germans, how we think about how Germans respond to the Holocaust. People say, oh, well, they live in a police state. They couldn't really have stopped this. I mean, they could have done something if they wanted to. And we see this in how what Hitler and Himmler and others wanted to do vis-a-vis the Christian churches, they just couldn't for political reasons, because Germans would not accept it. So on the one hand, they are anti-Christian, and you can certainly see how a rejection of the humanitarian elements that are foundational to Christianity, a rejection of that very much informs and justifies their violent tendencies. They often equated the egalitarianism, the equality, tenets of equality in Christianity, you know, the first will be last and all that. They often equated that with communism. They said this is essentially communism, which they also associate. Everything bad is associated with Jews in the Nazi mentality, right? Capitalism, democracy, communism, Christianity, all of it is labeled to be Jewish, because Jews are seen as the arch enemy, the ultimate source of evil. They equate Christianity in a lot of ways with communism and say, again, this is antithetical to our Darwinian survival of the fittest, might makes right philosophy of life. On the other hand, and you mentioned this, you can't get Nazi anti-Semitism without 1,500 years before that of Christian anti-Semitism, or anti-Judaism, if you want to call it that. Anti-Semitism is, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively new word. It's only coined in the late 19th century. Without that kind of foundation, the Holocaust, I don't think, could have happened. That's not to say that the Holocaust did happen because of Christianity. It's just that this aspect of Christianity, of Christianity's application and practice over thousands of years of violence and persecution against Jews, very much laid the groundwork for key aspects of Nazi anti-Semitic ideology. So a short runway of saying this is, you know, Christianity does different things at different times, depending on who's manipulating it, who's going against it. But I don't think it's fair to say that atheism is the cause of this. There are a number of different ideological elements that lead to the Holocaust that are essential to Nazi ideology, that in many ways come out of religion, that come out of Christianity, some of which kind of Nazi ideology is framed in opposition against. Like I said, this idea of equality that Christianity in theory preaches, the Nazis didn't like that. They didn't like that at all. They associated it with communism. On the other hand, basically all of the key tropes of Nazi anti-Semitism, they come out of Christian lore. So it's not like you can say Christianity is the root cause of this, or the absence of Christianity is the root cause of this either. It works into Nazi ideology and policy in a more complex way than that, than certainly in a more complex way than what would justify saying that this is all because of atheism. I mean, there are plenty of devoutly Christian or otherwise religious regimes that have committed all kinds of horrendous atrocities in the name of God. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a problematic argument.
Yeah. With that. Okay, well, I'm going to show my bias now and get on my soapbox a little bit, because I am an atheist, and it is pretty upsetting to hear people claim that atheism is the reason for Hitler to have been so cruel. They'll claim that atheists have no moral foundation. They seem completely fine with the notion that the only thing keeping people from committing genocide is a belief in God, or to have grown up in a Judeo-Christian society. Mm-hmm. I think this is preposterous. If anything, this allegiance to a group is what I see as bad, mm-hmm. whether it is considered religious or not. So any dogma or irrefutable belief that you cannot question and you must accept the tenets of, even when evidence suggests it is incorrect, is bad.
Absolutely.
Religiousness is a devotion to something, not just anything. We are devoted to many things that we would normally not call religious devotion. Mm-hmm. I think we can define it further and say it's devotion built on faith. Mm-hmm. And putting one's belief in a leader and pledging loyalty to a leader like Nazis did with Hitler, even when that leader is telling you to kill others, then in my opinion, that is tantamount to religious devotion. It's obvious when it happens in a cult.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think we can consider Nazis to be a cult, a death cult. Yeah. And, you know, there are scholars who have framed both Nazism and Soviet communism as political religions, because they do draw on the same kinds of psychological processes and demands on people. They draw on a need, a really basic human need, I think, the need to feel like you belong to something greater than yourself. There's a lot of religion baked into these, or religious elements baked into these atheist ideologies, whether we're talking about Nazism or communism. And I think you're absolutely right to focus on that as something that makes people not question the ideology. Mm-hmm. And that's really the main danger here. When any lie can be told, any truth can be obscured or set aside, any moral principle can be set aside in the name of a supposedly infallible and absolute ideology that brooks no compromise, that brooks no argument. That's the real danger. When you start to see that, be worried. You know, and to tie it back to your question about this and your comments, your follow-up comments, as someone who's looked at the history of mass violence throughout history, not just in, you know, during World War II in Europe, my feeling about it is that both religion and atheism, like, they bring out whoever the person is. They don't make people bad or good. They just accentuate whether that person is good or bad to begin with. If you're a vicious, power-hungry son of a bitch and you become religion, you're going to use religion to support your ambition and your hunger for power. Same thing goes with atheism. You can use that. You can manipulate it for nefarious ends. But neither religion nor atheism are inherently prone to violence. I mean, that's just, I agree. It's preposterous to say that.
Well, I don't know. I'll agree and kind of disagree. I feel that religion could be weaponized in that it's dogmatic belief, and mm-hmm. that dogma can get you to do things that you otherwise wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Whereas atheism, you know, I don't even want to think of it as a theism. I prefer non-dogmatic mm-hmm. beliefs. Like, if we get more scientific evidence, then we should change our beliefs based on that scientific evidence.
Yeah.
That is a non-dogmatic belief system. I still believe like science to be true, but I'm not holding it dogmatically, mm-hmm. those beliefs, right? And I think that there's this danger with dogma mm-hmm. that religion has that belief in science does not have. Mm-hmm. That dogma is very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of what I'm getting at in terms of how, you know, let's take the communism under Stalin as an example. Here's something where atheism is manipulated as part of a dogma, where atheism is part of the dogma that is twisted and used to justify violence against people who are religious, for one thing, but also against supposed class enemies, right? Or political opponents of any kind. The communists would say, at least Stalinists would say, you're opposing the dialectical march of history based on scientific laws. This is what communists believe, that what Karl Marx had identified were laws of history, were laws of human nature that were independent of any God, right? Like, that's essential to communist ideology. But if you stand in the way of that, then you're the problem and you have to go. What I'm getting at here is atheism can become sort of sucked into its own kind of dogma. That's why I think it is useful to think of these totalitarian movements as political religions, because they do become their own dogmas. They do become their own unquestioned ideologies with their own worldview that leads to all sorts of horrendous things, regardless of whether they're atheist or not. I think that's where I'm getting at. I guess I can see the point of perhaps religion is more susceptible to that kind of weaponization and demonization.
Well, I think it's more clear that you're getting this is how things should be with that dogma. Whereas, you know, your example with the Soviets, just because you can explain things in nature, this is how these things came about. They made the leap of this is how things should be.
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
And absolutely. And you know, another way of thinking about this is, I mean, we can use Nazi Germany as another example here. The Nazis believed they were acting in accordance with science. They believed they were acting in accordance with scientific laws, not Marxist laws, again, which are, you know, not accurate either. But for the Nazis, race was a scientific objective fact. So what I'm saying here is that science, like religion, can be manipulated for these violent purposes. And by extension, that means neither is inherently conducive to that, but can be used for that purpose. You know, yes, looking back, certainly over the history of Europe, a lot of horrendous crimes are justified with religion. But the Holocaust was justified by science, a perversion of science, no doubt. Just as I would say, you know, how the Nazis used Christianity is a perversion of Christianity. You know, it's the application of the ideas here, I think, that's important to bear in mind, which gets back to my sense that, you know, religion doesn't make people good or bad. Science doesn't make people good or bad. Just it's people use them for their own ends. And that's how you get things like the Holocaust or, you know, the terror famines in Ukraine under Stalin or something like that. Because as you said, the dogma is really the problem here, the unquestioning nature, the blind obedience.
Right. Maybe I shouldn't call myself atheist and just anti-dogmatist.
Maybe that's better. That's better.
So I would disagree a little bit about how some of this is just the perversion of religion, because if you read the Bible literally, it's got some pretty bad parts to it.
Absolutely.
That if you believe it to be infallible in the Word of God and you base your morality on it, I'm scared what you might do if you literally take it to be the Word of God.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, there's no disagreement there. But, you know, the Bible, as with any major spiritual text, you can kind of make it do what you can make it say whatever you want it to say. You know what I mean? If you want to use the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth as a motive or a justification for being a social activist, there's plenty of examples of that throughout history of using that to help people. Are there probably more examples of people using the more intolerant aspects of the Bible to demonize and destroy other human beings? Probably. But that's what I mean by it can do both. It's not inherently
Well, it's got enough self-contradiction that it can be applied however you kind of feel like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think the core of the consensus here would be that unquestioned belief is the enemy.
Yeah. You point out in your book, this superiority complex and pursuit of conquering a land by Nazis is similar to the U.S.'s concept of manifest destiny. I found this to be a great counterexample to the belief that growing up in a Judeo-Christian faith is what is keeping me from becoming a Nazi, when those early settlers believing this manifest destiny were primarily Christians.
Absolutely.
They believed they were superior to the natives and they would call them savages. And the majority Christian nation was apt to impose anti-miscegenation laws.
Yeah, I mean, this is another great example. I stake no claim to originality with that comparison. This is something a lot of Germanist historians and Americanist historians have pointed out, the similarities in how the Nazis and German nationalists before them too viewed Eastern Europe as sort of their frontier and westward expansion of the United States. But I mean, this is another good example, right? Religion was used to justify the slave trade. Religion was used to justify colonial expansion and frontier genocide in the United States. And before the United States, or even the United States, the 13 colonies, and then after the American Revolution too. So yes, I think that is a very good counterpoint to this idea that religion or Christianity somehow acts as a block or impediment to mass violence. Absolutely not. Our own national history totally refutes that assumption.
Right. Switching gears, there has been mass immigration occurring in Europe the last few years, and a nationalist movement seems to be occurring in response.
Mm-hmm.
Is this nationalist movement a concern for you?
It is. You know, it has been. I think the danger is greater in Eastern Europe for a variety of reasons. Particularly if we see what in Hungary is essentially a dictatorship now. Poland kind of veering in that direction. Again, with people just using this tool straight out of the fascist playbook, that you demonize the other, you demonize the foreigner, you demonize the immigrant. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned, because it's instructive for Europeans, temporary Europeans and contemporary Americans. Like, this is baked into the Nazi Party platform, this idea of we will not accept the immigration, the intake of others, foreigners. It's a warning about where that kind of rhetoric can lead. Not that it has to lead to that. It certainly is a tool for consolidating authoritarian power and authoritarian violence.
Yeah. The problem is they're not completely unjustified, that a large immigrant population coming in can be dangerous, you know, and they are not necessarily assimilating into their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a lot of terrorist attacks in Europe by these immigrants and some radicalization. So what should you do, though? I mean, just let these people die in their countries where they're getting attacked? What should they have done? What could they have done? What can we do now? Do you have any
solutions? I mean, so the problem is that, you know, again, we don't want to idealize and valorize what are typically perceived to be groups of victims. Because that's just dehumanizing them in a way, too, by ignoring the fact that there are bad actors among them. There are bad actors among every group of people, every society. You're absolutely right about that. The problem is that gets so overblown to the point where everyone in a particular group category is tarred with that brush totally unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every example of, let's just say, militant Islamist terrorism in Europe or the United States, there's the counterpoint of domestic white nationalist, white supremacist terrorist violence too. Like, no one has a monopoly on that. As to the question of whether immigrants in Europe should, let's say just immigrants from the Middle East, should assimilate into the dominant mainstream society. I mean, if you value a pluralistic, diverse society, then that should not be an expectation. And I don't think someone who wants to maintain their ethnic culture, as many European immigrants to the United States did in the 19th and early 20th centuries, I think it's a big problem when you start to declare that to be a political threat. We know from the history of the United States, and this is true of many Western European countries as well, that although this isn't inevitable by any means, because nothing's really inevitable, you know, that second generation immigrants, they do assimilate just because they want to belong to the majority society. So that question, you know, my response to that would be, if you value a diverse and pluralistic liberal society, small L liberal, democratic, small D society, then that you shouldn't be concerned about that. If you're concerned about immigrants being terrorists or being criminals, I also say, you know, look to the terrorists and criminals in your own ranks too, and maybe address that problem first. I think there's plenty of room to, you know, open the doors to people who are legitimately in need of help because of what's going on in their own country. I think Syria is a good example of this, or more recently Ukraine. You know, I think there's plenty of room for that. And I would consider myself a proponent of the idea that it has made America stronger, that it's made Germany, for instance, a stronger country. This a very vibrant tradition post-World War II of immigration from the Middle East, particularly from Turkey, a large Turkish German minority. I see that as a boon and an advantage, not a disadvantage. And whatever problems that come with it, they can be addressed sort of short of saying, well, let's establish a dictatorship and not let anyone in and kick all these others out.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of slippery slope arguments of any kind, but given what I study, I'm obviously biased in the sense that I see more of the slippery slope trajectories leading to authoritarianism and violence than the other way around. That's just how I'm primed as a scholar, given what I focus on. So mm-hmm. I don't think the downsides here justify the response that we've seen in places like Hungary or Poland, to some extent in France, to some extent in Germany, although the far right party there really is sort of receding since the last election.
Yeah, there were some deep concerns.
When they were the third largest party in the Reichstag, I was not happening again.
And it seems to be a response to this immigration. Probably my last question. One of my greatest concerns is the possibility of our democracy failing. Our nation was won with blood, and I fear it will be lost with blood. I see a former president making unsubstantiated claims of an unfair election as extremely dangerous. And when I hear him stating that a single person, the vice president, could have overturned the results of an election, right, I am very alarmed, and that is fueling people to give up on democracy. I also find the political parties and their constituents' eagerness to not only win, but to wipe out the opposing party off the face of the earth by any means necessary to be alarming. Are you at all alarmed, or is this another example of inappropriately making a comparison with Hitler?
No, I mean, I am alarmed because, as I said, where we started out, you know, there are parallels and similarities here in terms of ideology, in terms of tactics. Again, this notion that there's an infallible leader who cannot be questioned and anything is justified in the name of his or the movement's success, that any lie can be told. And that really, I mean, the utter maliciousness, the utter mendacity of a lot of sort of higher up Trump supporters, where it's just like they can just go on and on and on and lie, like that. The fact that
as long as they're owning the libs, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right. That's exactly right. I mean, the way that can just be justified internally because of the supreme confidence that your own worldview is absolutely correct, dogmatic. That's the danger I see right now. And you know, you can find some of that, I guess, on the left, but it's obviously more prominent on the right. There's just no way around this. Like, as an objective observer, that is clearly, I see that clearly more on the right than the left, whereas the left is, you know, internal disagreements about everything.
Right. They will eat their own.
You know, so that's those kinds of psychological dynamics, the groupthink, the blind obedience, the dogmatism, the justification of anything, but also, you know, to your point about the big lie, you know, the erosion of institutions,
mm-hmm.
the erosion of trust in institutions that is being deliberately worsen. That's a parallel with, you know, we can look for instructive, I don't want to say lessons, but examples from how the Weimar Republic fell apart, you know, where people say, oh, well, the Germans, they didn't really know how to do democracy. No, they did. They had a functioning liberal parliament for 60 years, more or less, before the Nazis seized power. And that functioning parliament was the supreme political authority between the end of World War I and the rise of the Nazis. People gave up on that. It's not that they didn't know how to do democracy. They did. They chose to turn their backs on it because they felt that it didn't work because trust in it was eroded.
Yeah.
That, I think, is incredibly scary, particularly when it's coupled with, so this gets at what you said too, a willingness to use political violence. January 6th insurrection is obviously the clearest example of this.
Right.
The willingness to say, we don't care what the actual results of the election were. Those must be fake because these people are evil. Therefore, we're justified in doing whatever we need to do, however horrible it might be, to get our way. Yes, that's a toxic dynamic that definitely worries me.
Yeah. Well, that's all my questions. Thanks for taking the time.
Sure.